Okay, this is session 32, recorded on March 11th, 2007, side one, and I'm going to pick up with the thought I got cut off in the last session, where I was talking about the difference between the media, and that term in the early 60s, and then the later term you mentioned, simulacrum. So the early phase of the Android meme is the media. As I was saying, people thought it was something over there that was interfering with their lives or influencing something that's over there. Then you say, yeah, the simulacrum is a seamless web. In a sense, the media was a seamless web, but people could not see that. So it seemed to be the TV set across the room. But once you get into the computer phase of the 80s, the media has gone inside, and the term for that might be the simulacrum, as Baudrillard meant it. It wasn't that well known in the 80s. It became well known in the 90s. So the simulacrum represents the later phase, a later perception of the Android meme as being inside you. The media were inside you. You know, radio and television are inside you, but people didn't see that. But once it became more intimate with the close computer screen that people were experiencing at work and wherever, the word processor, it was maybe felt to be more invasive and gone inside you. And so the idea of the media being a bit separate from you was eclipsed by something going inside you, and then you start getting all the robot imagery and cyborg imagery in the 80s, like Gibson's book Neuromancer, which comes out in 1984. So the simulacrum represents the perception of that factor, that part of the Android meme that's inside you. So that's an ostensible statement of the difference between the world that McLuhan described, the media, and the world that Baudrillard was describing.
Here's an interesting bit of trivia. I just looked up the word simulacrum. Origin, late 16th century. I thought that was a modern cybernetic word that, you know, was just made up recently. But from the Latin, simular, and an image or representation of someone or something, an unsatisfactory imitation or substitute.
Yeah, I know that Baudrillard, in one of his first books, the book, maybe it's in the Simulation and Simulacra, or the one before it, maybe that was called Forget Foucault, I can't remember, but in one of his earliest books, late 70s, early 80s, he talks about the three or four orders of simulacra. So he starts around the time of the 16th century and talks about the first type of simulacrum. So him being a scholar, he maybe found the word when he was looking through that period of history and culture. So It came from that period that he begins with. Okay, so now we're going to, with that in mind, let's read the last paragraph of the quote we were doing last week, which is the first quote in the Croker section of the book, which is a quotation from the book Croker made with David Cook called The Postmodern Scene, and this is the opening paragraphs in the introduction or preface of the book. So, reading the last paragraph, which I think we got cut off, in the last session, didn't complete it. Refusing with Nietzsche the pragmatic compromise which only seeks to preserve. So the compromise seeks to preserve. So refusing that, in other words, not compromising, the postmodern scene, Croker's book, can recommend so enthusiastically panic reading because it seeks to relieve the gathering darkness by a new and more local cultural strategy. That is to theorize, and that's in italics, that is to theorize with such hyper-intensity that the simulacrum is forced finally to implode into the dark density of its own detritus, and also to write, and that's in italics, and to write so faithfully under the schizoid signs of Nietzsche and Bataille that burnout, discharge, and waste, as the characteristic qualities of the postmodern condition, are compelled to reveal their lingering traces on the afterimages of our bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy. Hyper-theory, therefore, for the end of the world.
You know, I just noticed here where he talks about the gathering darkness and then the implode into the dark density of its own detritus. Well, tactility is dark, right? I mean, it's isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, McLuhan
said you're going to assign a.
It's not dark. It doesn't have a color. But McLuhan said, to illustrate tactility, you'd use the color black. But
yeah,
that would be the after image of tactility. So yes, we were. Now, what's interesting is that, you know, TVH was tactile. Then we started to move into the Android meme phase, which was sort of not involving humans, even though it seduced humans. So the tactility of the previous television age became figure. So the Android meme phase is considered dark, but it's really post-tactility, so therefore the tactile becomes visible. And McLuhan talks about the post-tactile in that op-ed for the New York Times called A Media Approach to Inflation. It's one of the few times where you see where he talks about how the world market became a gambling casino playing with the tactile intervals in the futures of the market objects,
mm-hmm,
and market commodities. So that's it's important. And I don't know if Croker would know that, but when he talks about the schizoid writing under the schizoid signs of Nietzsche and Bataille, that's beginning to intuit being a quadriphenic. It doesn't matter that you're splitting and being contradictory or whatever, or even that you're failing, that you're representing burnout, discharge, and waste.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're miming the fact that there are lingering traces, which is like after images, or like tactility, on the after images of our bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy. There ain't no chemical bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy.
Right.
So it's getting very close to intuiting the post-information age, the later phases of the Android meme, where the Android meme makes itself disappear.
Yeah. And,
so that's pretty good stuff here in this paragraph to help illustrate what Bob's talking about.
Yeah. In a way, tactility is not visualizable, then to visualize it as being black is to give it a sort of an after image, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, the word schizoid, denoting or having a personality type characterized by emotional aloofness or solitary habits.
That's a tribal deadpan, you could say.
Uh-huh.
The blank face of being cool.
Yeah. In informal use, resembling schizophrenia and having inconsistent or contradictory elements.
Right, so that would be maybe the verbal part, and the postural or visual part is the deadpan face, like the Andy Warhol visage.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly not emotional, not responding.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a verbal and a pictorial or visual meaning of schizoid here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we could do...
So when
I'm not in that paragraph, and you're going to find that he's going to continuously cycle around that insight.
Right.
Describing this impossible post-media situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the next section is taking various media like politics or topics, politics, money, noise, what else has he got here, waiting, questions. This is going to be long quotes, or a quote that's very long, but he's inventorying all the panic and panic syndromes in life, or in fashion, in media, in the Android meme. So the first one's going to be panic politics. So we're describing the 80s. Now, if you notice on the Eben Ray dialogue I had with Croker, he says in either section one or section two, or the first interview or the second interview, that the panic scene that he described in the 80s, he feels actually is more apt for this decade.
Mm-hmm.
And he said we have panic wars and other things. But panic war, people would see that Iraq is a panic war.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to...
Yeah, I wonder what it is about. He said that, you know, guys like... Well, he referred to a couple of philosophers who he thought kind of hit it on the head, but that they were writing about a time maybe a decade before. In other words, their work became more relevant in the future.
Yeah.
So what was it about these guys that they were actually, you know, intuiting something that they were perceiving the effects before the causes or something?
Well, he writes a whole book on that, The Possessed. Yeah, I think it's called The Possessed Individual, where he talks about the major French postmodern thinkers and how they had a good eye on understanding America because they watched what America did to France. Mm-hmm. And so they had that detachment. Like McLuhan said, Canadians had a detachment in relation to the United States. The French, at least for a university, academic stuffy discourse, they had the training in intellectual jargon, and then they took that and confronted the American global environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the French detachment, or the French, like, being totally out of sync with this American global environment, and therefore taking an askew view of it, or obtuse view of it.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to reconcile their complex verbal Heideggerian existentialist, philosophical, phenomenological bookish tradition and trying to relate it to the McLuhan world.
Yeah.
So they were trying to translate McLuhan back into their percept.
Yeah.
Now, you know, what's her name? Camille Paglia, she says, in the early 90s, she started saying, well, these French guys really had no real perception of the American environment, so she critiques all these people that Croker is praising. But Croker spells out in the book, The Possessed Individual, why the French had a unique and almost genius view of what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would stand to reason they would tend to be cynical if they believe that there's a virtual invasion of America into, you know, their politics and economy and stuff.
No, they weren't cynical.
Well,
a popular interpretation of them being detached, in a sense.
Mm. Well, you know, when a country's invaded, the people are going to tend to be cynical about the invading force.
Yeah, but Croker, you'll see in here, describes the cynicism, the cynical characteristics of the American environment.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean he's a cynic.
Right.
But he maybe would put on the cynical mean, M-I-E-N, or attitude or patina because he's going to mime the postmodern scene.
Yeah.
But everybody used to think Baudrillard was totally pessimistic and negative because he was describing the end of the world. But
right.
He was, if you understood him, it didn't mean that he was negative. He was describing the end of communication.
Mm-hmm.
The end of the real, he called it.
Yeah. Well,
he didn't cause it.
Right. As a footnote to the last session, you mentioned that movie, The Mouse That Roared, with Peter Sellers. I looked up the storyline on that, and there was a little country that felt that they couldn't keep up with the technological age, or I think you referred to last week, the satellite tactility. So they created an imaginary threat to get the United States to go to war with them, invade them, and then they thought, and then we'll get them to rebuild us, and then we'll have all their technology.
Right, now that's what I said.
Yeah.
Do you remember me? That's
no, you did say that.
What'd you say?
You said that. I didn't quite get it till I looked up the storyline, because
then you got it. You had time to think about it.
Yeah.
It might have been based on Cuba. Castro.
Yeah,
Cuba.
Right. So
it's a funny idea.
Another response to being, you know, feeling like you're invaded. Now, what did you refer? You referred to the word satellite tactility. Is that?
That's not TV tactility. TV is a tactile medium.
Uh huh.
But once the satellite goes around the environment, and then you have all these other environments, older environments, TV, radio, bulldozers, highways, cars, magazines, newspapers, all these media and books, they interact inside the satellite environment. So it's all the artifacts that are interplaying. And I mean by the phrase satellite tactility, the interplay of these different older environments.
Mm-hmm.
Not the tactility of the TV, one medium, TV, that's an extension of the tactility of our senses.
Right.
So satellite tactility is the mixed corporate media global theater interaction.
Yeah. So would you say that's what these French postmodernists were responding to, the satellite tactility?
Yeah.
Although that would have come in the 60s, right?
Right,
maybe
but
before Croker wrote this.
Yes, and they start writing in the late 60s, early 70s, Baudrillard in the late 60s. But they are reacting. Remember, the effect, the visual effect of that interplay is the hologram. You don't see a hologram, but the interplay of all the media and the word making the market and the word being being the coherency out of the White House, the coherency of an image that represents this whole interplay, this satellite tactility, that's effectively people are living inside a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
Big, huge hologram. And then the digital technology compresses that hologram more and more in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But it's a big hologram in the 60s, and many of the intellectuals and students and radicals, they called it the automated monster.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a more hardware view of it. They didn't get the subtle software threads of it, software interstices. And that is the satellite tactility. Only McLuhan saw that. It's not a big, monstrous Orwellian thing. It's something that's inside you and that you're dancing to.
Yeah.
And that subtlety, maybe Baudrillard was the best to do that because he spent the most time absorbing McLuhan. So
yeah.
He started to see this situation. He wrote a book called Seduction.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the feminine, not the chemical body feminine, but the feminine as the essential principle of seduction.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his way of describing the hologramic effect.
Right.
You'll see Croker talks about the American environment as a world hologram.
Mm-hmm. And what phase are we talking about with the satellite tactility, from what years?
Well, on the chart, Croker is 72 to 77, crystallized around 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes noticeable, and I mean, the postmoderns are describing it in the 70s. And they are rearview mirror in the sense that they don't see that it's shrinking and actually becoming user-friendly. So in that sense, by the 90s, people could say that the postmoderns were cynical, negative, and felt that the human was inside an oppressive environment, an oppressive simulacrum.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they would argue with that, but that's how they were perceived. And I would say that they failed to see the shrinking, the disappearance of the hologram.
So you're using the satellite tactility and the Android meme as similar metaphors.
Yeah, the satellite tactility is before the Android meme, but the digitization that starts to grow in the 60s during the time of the satellite tactility is going to shrink the hologramic effect of the satellite tactility. Think of satellite tactility as the part of your brain that organizes the sensor data and then creates a coherent image around you, which is reality, and that's... Some people say, well, it's just a hologram or just a simulation produced by your brain. Well, take that idea and say that the satellite is making all the interactions between all the older media environments into a coherent hologram. And that hologram is the news or the interest rates or whatever dominating image that's presented by the White House.
Right.
And then translated by the New York Times, individual space, newspaper space. So... satellite tactility, in a way, prefigures the Android meme, but the Android meme is the post-satellite environment. So you have in my chart, you have radio, holopathic radio satellite, holopathic TV satellite, holopathic computer satellite. Those are replays of earlier massive environments, and they're shrinking. That's what I mean by the term holopathic. And then the Croker is satellite squared. Croker, describing the Android meme, is describing the digitalized shrinking, but he still projects the huge hologramic effect on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one who emphasizes the disappearance of the Android meme.
Right.
But Croker in the 90s does sort of catch up to that idea, but we're looking at Croker in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So the French guys may not have been able to see the satellite squared situation. They're describing the big hologram.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Croker said Baudrillard and them describe pretty well the satellite tactility. But Croker gets into the chip effect, which is the Android meme phase.
Right. So in addition to seeing what was going on in the environment, did Baudrillard and these guys feel that their own psyches were somehow being turned into simulacrum, that their own sense of identity or authentic sense of self or something like that was being diminished or replaced?
Well, in Croker's book, The Possessed Individual, he goes through the six or seven famous postmodernists, and he shows how each one of them was totally different and disagreed with the other.
Mm.
So, personally, they had all kinds of responses.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Foucault, he took LSD when he was in America in the late 70s, early 80s at some point, and that was, I don't know much about it. I never read his biography. I think that was an interesting experience for himself, but then he got AIDS, and he died.
Mm.
And Derrida went on writing complex Manipian texts, and Virilio was lobbying to create a museum of huge industrial and media accidents.
Mm-hmm.
They all did different perverse, eccentric, individual, idiosyncratic personal responses to the situation.
So I assume Foucault was gay if he died of AIDS.
Yeah.
Did all these guys experiment with homosexuality?
I understand Barth was a homosexual. I don't think Baudrillard was. Virilio was a priest almost. I don't know if he was a Catholic priest, but he lived like a priest. He was afraid to fly, so he couldn't travel much.
Mm.
And let's see, Deleuze and Guattari, I don't know. They were probably bisexual, though I don't know anything about them in their personal lives. Lyotard was more of a dandy. He might have been gay, but I don't know. So I only know that Foucault and Barth were gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume Baudrillard wasn't. Baudrillard was married.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Secretly married, apparently.
Oh.
Yeah, not too many people knew he was married in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why he would want to keep that a secret.
Well, it's probably, I don't know if he kept secret, just people didn't seem to know it.
Mm.
This is what someone told me. I didn't know that people didn't know it, but I wasn't living in France. I didn't know what French people knew about him.
Right.
But I think Sever told me that.
Yeah. Now, something a little bit off topic, but probably worth mentioning just for the sake of contrast.
Because we should say this and get it on tape. We're doing our second day of Croker, and we want to say that we did our first day last Sunday, and Baudrillard died, or it was announced he died, the next day, on Tuesday or Wednesday, after we had done we had broken into the Croker zone on Monday. So we want that on record, that once we started turning the Croker section into an audio book, the pressure was too much for Baudrillard. Off he went. And you notice that I posted there on various lists that we knew he had cancer for the last 2 years.
Yeah, right.
Baudrillard's friend wanted Carolyn's advice, and mm-hmm. Carolyn gave some advice. I think she recommended 714X, and Baudrillard said, nah, I'm comfortable with what I'm getting from my doctor, and so he didn't want to change.
Uh-huh.
So what were you going to say?
Well, your chart is 60 to 210 or 212 or something?
No, there's two charts. The big one is 1750 to 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Then the inside chart, which is represents the 1960 to 1990 phase, is what's called the tiny note chart.
Right, 60 to 90. Right.
Yeah, which is the Android meme.
Yeah. Well, 90s are post-Android meme.
Right, the chart is a mirror of the figure in the 90s. The figure in the 90s, the Android meme. That means the ground is something else.
Oh, okay.
And so I say the ground is a hexatic position, and so from the ground you're looking at the old environment, which is now figure, and everybody's involved in it. The picture of that figure in the 90s is my tiny note chart.
Right. So this week I saw a movie which just preceded your tiny note chart because it was made in 1956. Was called The Forbidden Planet. And I was really impressed by the You know, a lot of the UFO and conspiratorial stuff people are thinking about today was all in that movie. They had holograms, transport beams, faster than light flying saucer. They get to this planet that had once been colonized by these guys called the Krell, who were a million years in advance of us technologically. And there's one human living on that planet, and he's mind melding with the Krell, with the Krell technology. And when he does so, his libido becomes entangled with the immense energy generate. These machines can generate energy almost unlimited power. So this Krell computers, it's this huge, huge, vast computer network this guy's living inside of. And his libido gets entangled with the Krell technology and creates manifestations in the environment of these electronic monsters, which, you know, kill anybody who comes around to, you know, threaten his territory. And I thought that was pretty advanced for 1956. I was actually quite surprised that they were all, you know. But anyway, that movie just preceded your chart and seemed to predict a lot of what's in your chart.
Well, the movie is considered a classic. I don't remember. I don't remember the details. I think I saw it in the 50s, but I don't. I never even thought much about it until I started seeing pop culture lists in the 80s, and 90s. They listed Forbidden Planet as a great movie. So it was interesting to hear what you're saying. It reminds me vaguely. If I remember, there'd be things would disappear. There'd be someone there, and then they'd disappear. Right? There was a lot of disappearing going on.
Yeah.
That's what I remember from that. So I haven't had a chance to check out a lot of pop culture favorites or things that have become archetypal now. I haven't had time, but it's interesting you did see that. I guess I have to look at it and see. I mean, disappearance, I guess the theme of disappearance is the digital, the digital effect. But usually you can't describe the Android meme in any medium. The closest probably that describes the Android meme is Finnegan's Wake. But to make a movie, you're limited to the movie medium.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're in radio, you're limited to the radio. No one medium can describe the Android meme. That's what's so good about the Wake, about Finnegan's Wake, is that using the technology of the book, he could absorb, at least conceptually, verbally, referentially, every medium.
Mm-hmm.
He could include all media. And the book is unique that way.
Hmm.
Now, McLuhan said that the movie contains all media.
Right.
You can see it. But the
I had a question about that because...
Well, but hold on, let me just say it. So the ongoing nature of the post-movie environment where there's actually, it's a quantum reality where the TV is presenting absences and presences rapidly, you know, every minute. How do you describe that part of the electronic environment? Well, Finnegan's Wake does that by emphasizing no content, just glimmers of content. And that's something the movie medium, it can contain all media, but the period post-media, the seamless web, is very hard for movies to portray, and a lot of the experimental avant-garde movies of the 60s tried to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I say that no medium can express what the Android meme is.
Mm-hmm.
So it just becomes too literal. Okay, so what was it? What were
well, the say? Movie contains all media mediums. Does that mean that it contained mediums that...
Media
that hadn't been invented yet when they were making movies in the 30s and
40s? Yeah, you could say Forbidden Planet shows media that haven't been invented. But they don't show the satellite tactility, the interplay, the invisibility of the tactile environment when the satellite has got all these other media environments as its content. The interplay, the tactility. How do you show that? It's like McLuhan making the film, and we discussed that, I think. He made the film by projecting a camera on the wall with no content.
Right.
That's a beginning, but that's not a movie for most people. It's a nothing, but it's an attempt to take an artifact and conceptualize it. It's interesting, conceptual art surfaces in the 60s in the period of satellite tactility. It's like a thought. We were now been moving beyond the speed of light and moving at the speed of thought. So thought art came in. It's called concept art. So it's the imminent quantum-like nature of media communication among its parts that the movie, that is post-movie. The movie just contains all the artifacts that led up to that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't quite grasp this idea of the speed of thought, what that intends to indicate.
Well, thought is faster than the speed of light.
Well, how do you measure that?
Right. Anyway, what that makes bring in the question of how do humans connect and where does the meme come from?
Mm-hmm.
Thought may be well. What is thought? You know, where is it? Where is it? Nothing, and then when, and then it becomes something. So the ineffability.
And how do we even say that it travels? I mean,
right. Well, that's another point. It doesn't have to travel. It's instantly there. Everybody's in touch.
Well, that's implying the ESP idea. Everyone's in
touch. Right.
The same idea at the same time.
Yeah, the ESP, the analog media's cloned ESP, and the voluntary digital phase is the ability to disconnect from the instant thought ESP, or to put an artifact in front of you.
So is that part of the idea of the appearance and the reappearance and the appearance and the rapid appearance and reappearance, the ability to connect and disconnect?
Yeah, and that's tactility, connect and disconnect.
Uh-huh.
The idea that you can create, your thoughts can be translated into media immediately through editing and the modern digital equipment leading to YouTube is what I mean by voluntary ESP.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to mold the ESP that you're inside of or project your thoughts into the thought meme, the thought environment.
Yeah.
But, you know, all these expressions I'm saying are inadequate to perceiving what it is. That's why you can use quantum physics, subatomic particles as glimpses or metaphors, but then you say, well, the particles are not matter. The idea of subatomic particles are describing the actual experience people have when they have a radio or TV or any of these things in their cars or speeding along the highway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you just have to think of someone 300 years ago walked around in a mall or anything, you know, today, they just wouldn't be able to perceive where they were. Everything's too fast, too instant.
Hmm.
They think, well, okay, the sun's going down, time to go to bed. And the guy says, no, we don't need to. The sun carries on. How? Well, I turn on the switch. Look, we got light.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how'd that happen?
Hmm.
Then the old guy would say, or, you know, someone from 300, 400, 500 years ago would say, well, we got to eat. Let's go hunt. Oh, no, we got it right here.
Yeah.
Open a microwave oven, there's the food. Now, his brain would be forever out of sync with this. It wouldn't know how anything, it would be like living in a total manifestation of everything.
Right.
In a dream world.
Right.
Like going through the Bardos, right? Whatever you think, you manifest. Well,
right.
That's what you have to be aware of what we experience and take for granted. You have to hoik up previous modalities and sensibilities.
Right. Although we have the ability to trace back in a causal way, you know, where things come from.
Right.
And how things evolve.
But we don't fully master the full implications of the present.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we're saying, okay, I can think back and see the history of it.
Mm-hmm.
But with the way we live now, there is no you to think back.
Mm.
Because that's a subfocal linear thought process, which we are surrounded by something nonlinear,
mm-hmm.
which is surrounded. We are and it is the linear thought process. That's what's so...
That sounds like existentialism.
Right, but it's beyond that. And I was going to say that's what's so innovative about Finnegan's Wake. It describes that life.
Mm-hmm.
And it has no content. So it begins at the right point. It begins at the failure point of even trying to communicate it.
Mm-hmm.
So what'd you say it sounded like? I forget. You just said...
Existentialism.
Oh, yeah. Well, the word existentialism is referred to in Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
It's forever without standards or reference points.
Right.
But existentialism is a concept. You know, turning on the radio or TV is not a concept. It's an action.
Yeah. So even though he wrote that in the radio era before TV or computers or satellites were even happening yet, because he was writing from the point of view of tactility, and all these media, including satellites and computers are, and TVs are tactility, then he was, would you say he was describing all future electronic media as well?
Yeah, it's very important through his Jesuit training, Catholic training when he was a kid, of Thomas Aquinas, who was pretty good at conceptualizing the proportion of ratios among ratios, or the ratio of proportions among proportions, the interplay of tactility, because he had that, and McLuhan wrote about it, because he had that conceptual advantage, he could see maybe with the help of Wyndham Lewis, but he could see the tactile nature, and once he saw that, and no one else really got that, maybe, most people didn't, most other artists, once he got that, he had the key to the nature of at least the next 300 years.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's a good point you brought up there about the importance of the image of tactility.
Right.
And yeah, the word tactile is in Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Now, during his day, he could tune into his radio and hear all the languages, all these different voices bouncing off the ionosphere, creating this, you know, multicultural mix, and which prompted his intuition of the merging of cultures and languages and
not necessarily merging, because tactility is connecting and disconnecting, merging and blocking. Tactility does both actions.
Mm-hmm.
Merging is a visually biased image. Merging and canceling.
Mm. Yeah, so he's getting the merging and canceling in the radio, you know, however many signals, you know, were interpenetrating his radio antenna at that time. I heard an interesting statistic I hadn't thought about, actually, this last week. Somebody mentioned that, you know, you put a powerful radio antenna. This guy, Seth Shostak, he's part of the SETI project, where they're looking for signals from, you know, people were asking him, how do you differentiate one signal from another and discover even if you have anything significant. He says, you put a powerful radio antenna up, and that thing is exposed to multiple millions of signals per second. That's how thick our
bandwidth.
With communication information is, you know, multi-million signals per second. You know, each signal representing a communication between two, you know, a point and an end point.
You mean human artifacts?
No, but, you know, like if I pick up my cell phone and call you, there's a signal goes from my cell phone to your cell phone. Let's say that's one signal.
Yeah, you're talking about technological signals, not first nature signals.
Right, technological signals.
Yeah.
So imagine, you know, multi-million of these communication signals all, you know, you put your antenna out and it's just barraged with communication. The communication is so thick, if you could see it, it would look like a black.
You can see it. That's the brilliance of Finnegan's Wake. He visualizes that.
Yeah.
There's infinite meanings, you know, embedded in each page of Finnegan's Wake.
Right. And then something I guess worth pointing out, I don't know if we're getting a little off track here or not, but I guess when we're talking about communications, we're not just talking about the fact that right now I'm on one end of the line, you're on the other end of the line, and you know, we're both in two places at the same time. Our voices are sending signals to each other. But how many communications are going on between computers where there's no human intervention at all? One computer sending a transaction data to another computer. There's probably more communications going on that are totally invisible to any human being than the kinds of communications we think of where we're sending a signal over the TV from one guy's eye to the other guy's eye, or over the phone from one guy's ear to the other guy's ear, or whatever. And there's, you know, people are actually receiving and interpreting these communications.
Yeah, well, that's why you come up with the concept of the Android meme as something that's taking on a life of its own.
Yeah.
Communicating in its own zone. And, you know, P.K. Dick starts writing a paranoid visions in response to a globally controlled hologram. I mean, Philip K. Dick, his novels are about this feeling that something alien is taking over human communication. But I would say that's the satellite tactility phase. He's developing a paranoid relationship with the effect of satellite tactility, which is a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
And then he creates a scenario that the hologram has been around for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, there's other novelists. It's like Baudrillard is a better novelist. He never wrote novels, but he described the situation. But he didn't have to, and he did it pretty accurately, he didn't have to make human interest scenarios to show an emotional response to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
He just described it. I think Baudrillard talks about his stuff as prose poetry. But I'm bringing up that as an example of the inadequacy of what is popular in describing what is. I mean, Finningswake doesn't have any content, so what's the point? But then when you relate it to the coming complexity and compression and bandwidth that you just described, it is an appropriate image of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications for human thinking within it.
Yeah. Well, it has no content and it has all content. I think you have to say those things together.
Yeah, which is the nature of the electric age. We've got the Akashic Records externalized here.
Mm-hmm.
If the Akashic Records is human communication, just think of all the media that have recordings of human communication, and they're being transmitted all over the place. Or no place. Just resonating. That's another point of moving at the speed of light implies motion. Movement at the speed of thought, there's no motion. Everything's just in touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is hard to grasp. Most of us are not aware of some arena in which we're all having the same thought at the same time or something like that.
Yeah, I don't, maybe I've lived with it for too long, but I don't understand why, or I forget how hard it is for people to think about, but I just think, well, you just think about what, it's not hard to think and imagine there's all these signals going on.
See, it occurred to me with respect to synchronicity, because from time to time I experience coincidences that were not arranged by me or the other person, but they appeared to be arranged by something that encompassed the two of us. So I see that I have a private sense of identity, you have a private sense of identity, and there's this third entity which encompasses both of us, and it's organizing coincidences between the two of us and between us and other people.
Just hold that thought. That may be, we discussed this last week, that may be the generation of a meme. We, in our new hyper situation, we become aware, we intuit how a meme is created and how, why tribal societies in slower times had memes.
Mm-hmm.
We can now see what McLuhan said, the stages of the development of cognition, collective and personal. So we now can see this third element, or remember we were trying to describe what is a meme?
Yeah.
You just described the generation of a meme.
Well, what would be a meme for a tribal guy?
The effect of everybody using speech and what kind of social organization comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you bring in writing, which, you know, spreads over hundreds of years. The meme and the attitudes that writing societies develop was a product of the collective effect of everybody writing and having it as part of their environment. So when you describe all this third thing that's making synchronicity between two people, it's like the electric age allows us to see how human group mind was formed. We can actually pick it up or experience it because that's how fast we're moving or how transparent we're moving.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, we're not moving. Anyways, I just thought what you were describing sounds like the generation of how human minds could agree on the same language.
Mm-hmm.
In their culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, it's hard to describe, eh?
Yeah.
So let's go on to the next. Maybe we only got a few minutes left on this side.
Yeah, we do. About 3 minutes.
Okay, so we can carry this. What else would you say about this? So the Android meme is technology. We become aware of how a meme is formed, group mind is formed among humans.
Yeah. Now, this was the thing that, I always get his name messed up, but Teilhard Chardin, he was intuiting this group overarching, this sort of oversoul, this where all of our minds are networked together in one big thing that is, in a sense, autonomous. And we have to, in our private way, sort of confront the fact that, you know, we're inside this big autonomous thing that's got us all networked together, and it is working to bring some kind of a concrescence of all of our minds or something like that.
All right, now take that. As you say this, I think about his noosphere. He romanticized his own incipient beginning awareness of the meme formation. And so we're becoming aware of how humans form memes. But we're doing this because we're inside the computer, techno, and culture environment that is making memes within itself. And that's another thing that P.K. Dick might have got paranoid about, or Robert Anton Wilson. We're becoming aware of how humans form memes, and we're projecting, tired to shout and projected out as a new theological situation, yet it's the human meme generation is superseded by the android meme generation.
Yeah.
And so you end up having a president who doesn't have to say anything. Begins with Reagan, he just waves.
Mm.
Then you bounce it off with Bill Clinton, who is a slick emoter, supposedly. That's his, he's emoting. So that's another kind of human communication. And then that flips into, the dialectic of Reagan-Clinton flips into Bush, who doesn't bother to communicate anymore.
Right.
Which is maybe schizoid in the deadpan sense.
Right. Yeah, I heard somebody, a radio host guy, make this statement that I thought was apropos of Bush. He said something about, you know, increasing troops in the Middle East, and